And welcome to the oneliner.com movie review podcast. This week we are without Craig, who's on his honeymoon and clearly has far better things to do than sit around talking about films with us chumps. But what you do have is me, who's Drew, and him, who's Scott.
Hello.
And without further ado, Scott's going to tell us about our first film,
which is Splice, by Vincenzo Natali, a director you may have heard of from his previous adventures in Cube and Cypher. He's done a few things since then which kind of passed me by, but the name was enough to entice me to see Splice. If nothing else, his previous films had been stylish and had at least some merit to them. Splice doesn't, on either count. As down as a sci-fi thriller, what you have is Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley as two young, edgy, scientific masterminds. They are in the genetic engineering business, and after producing a strange worm-like creature which produces valuable chemicals for the medical markets, they seem to get a little bit bored with simply moving that small-scale project into production scale, and decide to go off and have a bit of fun by creating a very illegal human genetic spliced hybrid. And at this point, you can probably see the parallels with Frankenstein by yourself without needing me to draw any more of it. They produce this strange, freakish little creature, and the female of the pair, Elsa, becomes attached to her child. They try and raise it as best they can, despite the fact that it's a horrendous freak of nature. This film is, at heart, basically Frankenstein again. It's doing nothing particularly new or interesting, but it does seem to think that it is. There are some very strange scenes there where it's basically dealing with Clive, Adrian Brody's character's attraction to Dren, who it later transpires is basically Elsa's kid, which is used some of her DNA in these splicing experiments, and it seems to be playing off this kind of sexual attraction as having some kind of layer of depth other than just being really, really creepy. And regardless of where the genes came from, it's just going to be really, really creepy anyway, because the kid, Dren, as it grows up, has wings. It's just not human. It's weird and freaky and deviant. It's supposed to be, I think, hinting at sort of dark desires and that kind of thing, and exploring the darker sides of sexuality, but it just winds up being really weird and freaky and not very likeable. None of the characters are particularly likeable. Adrian Brody's Clive is, I suppose, nominally the hero of the piece, and he seems more or less a reasonable character, but he's hamstrung by the fact that he's clearly playing a character that was written to be about 20, and he's 36, and it's just he just can't pull off anymore. It's very much a role written for a hipster douche, and Adrian's many things, but he's no hipster douche, which he should be proud of, I guess. But and Elsa's, Sarah Polley's character, Elsa, is spiky and unlikable, and the other main character of the piece is this hideous mutant freak, Dren, who's supposed to be attractive, I imagine, but, you know, looks very, very strange and non-human, obviously. The film's not particularly good. It's not particularly interesting on any level. It's quite annoying the way they've reduced the science. For a film that seems to be having pretensions of being taken seriously, there's kind of CSI level of science where they just sort of throw some genes into a machine and sort of shake them up for a bit and then wait for half an hour.
Agitator.
Not particularly satisfying to see this kind of thing go through. And obviously the science behind it is, shall we politely say, questionable? But
I was going to go for non-existent, but you'd be perhaps slightly more diplomatic than I.
Yes, yes. No, it's just not very good. By the end of the film, it's really turned into nothing more than a kind of being destroyed by your own creation, and it turns into a little bit of a slasher towards the end, to be honest with you, but a very bad slasher. I mean, Natalie's done this sci-fi horror thing far better with his first major film, Cube, which is probably a far better bet if you want to watch something and go back and watch that rather than this again. No, I have really no way to recommend this on any level at all, so yeah, stay well away from this hideous little freak.
Yeah, I have done till now, so you've given me no reason to change my mind.
Yes, continue to do so.
So, next up we have Shrek Forever After, which is the fourth film in the series, and allegedly the last, though I hope you'll excuse my cynicism in suggesting that if this makes enough money for DreamWorks, Shrek 5 may well turn up sooner rather than never. After the previous three films sorted out Shrek's life pretty thoroughly, he now has a wife, friends, children, and no worries about becoming a king against his will, Shrek Forever After has had to go down the alternate reality route to introduce drama into Shrek's happy domestic existence. All this cosy domesticity, though, is getting to Shrek a bit. He no longer feels like a real ogre, and after an emotional outburst at his triplet's first birthday party, he meets one Rumpelstiltskin Esquire, an evil magician who lost his opportunity to own the kingdom of Far, Far Away when Shrek unexpectedly rescued Fiona from her tower prison and ruined all his plans. Harbouring resentment since that day, Rumpelstiltskin sees an opportunity when he sees the unhappy Shrek and offers him an opportunity for one day as a real ogre with no responsibilities at all, in exchange for one day, any will do, from Shrek's past. As is the way of such magical contracts in fairy tales, Shrek is tricked and the little goblin man takes the day of Shrek's birth. Shrek suddenly finds himself in a very different Far, Far Away, ruled by the curly-shoed weirdo, where ogres are fighting a resistance movement and are led in their cause by a Boudicca-like warrior queen who just happens to be Shrek's missus. Not that she or any of his other friends recognise him, of course. Now greenskin George Bailey has only a day to get his wife to fall in love with him again before he loses her and everything else forever. And he learns along the way just what a rich man he was. Yada yada yada. Be thankful for what you've got, blah blah blah. Which, frankly, is all a bit grown up for a kid's film. And what you'll probably want to know, though, is if it's any good. I would imagine so, anyway. Well, it's certainly better than Shrek the Third, to damn it with faint praise. And it's not an unenjoyable watch, but it's a pale shadow of the first two films. The Shrek series nowadays is getting a bit long in the tooth, and the characters and stories are feeling increasingly tired. There's also one really big problem with Shrek Forever After, however, and that's Rumpelstiltskin. The central villain's given a pretty hefty chunk of screen time and dialogue, and the actor voicing him just isn't up to the job. This said actor is Walter Dorn, a writer in the previous two Shrek films, and credited this time around as the somewhat nebulous head of story, whatever that means. Aside from a few minor voices in Shrek the Third, this is his first acting gig, and he gets a fail. His performance is flat, irritating and utterly uncompelling, and given that the villainous Rumpelstiltskin is so central to the plot, it threatens to undermine the whole film. The rest of the main voice cast, Mike Myers, Eddie Murphy, Cameron Diaz and Antonio Banderas, are solid enough, and they go some way to making up for Dorn, even if Myers, and possibly even Diaz's performances, are less enthusiastic than we're used to hearing them in this franchise. It's still at least watchable though, even if it doesn't come close to the lofty heights of the first two outings. There are enough jokes and set pieces to keep the whole family entertained, though it'll likely be more or less forgotten by the next morning. So I would say recommended, but with reservations. Oh yes, so a postscript to what I've just said. I think it tells you all you need to know about whether or not this film's worth seeing in 3D. When I tell you that I was absolutely certain I had seen this in regular 2D until about 2 minutes before we started recording this podcast, when I remembered I had in fact seen the 3D. Such was the impact it made on me.
I have very little, Dad. It's decent. I mean, I actually cannot remember anything from Shrek 3 at all, other than not liking it very much. So I suppose on that basis, this is a little bit better than it, but ultimately forgettable. I guess I like the Pied Piper. Other than that, it's okay.
Yeah, there's a few touches like the Pied Piper. There's a couple of bits that, I mean, they're reasonably fun, but it's just, it's nothing special in any way at all.
No, I mean, it's disappointing when you, it's like when you saw the first Shrek film and you thought that DreamWorks were actually, oh, well, this, you know, is now a serious contender for, like, decent 3D movies. It's got the quality of Pixar, but with a bit of an edge to it as well.
Yeah.
It's going to be really promising, and since then, they've under-delivered continually. And this is not really changing it. It's perfectly adequate. It's fine. It's worth watching, but I mean, there's certainly far better things you could see at a cinema of a similar ilk.
It's really quite a bit of a letdown, given that the last thing DreamWorks Animation did was a film that I was surprised to find I enjoyed quite so much, which was How to Train Your Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they achieved that heights and they've just come tumbling back down again, unfortunately.
Well, at least they've not tumbled down too far. It's relatively enjoyable. I'll laugh enough, I guess. Yeah, it's not dreadful, but you know, there's far better things you do with your time and money.
Yeah, it's by no means a bad film. It's just, there's so many things you could do that there's not any good reason to say go this when you could do anything else.
Yes, other than watch more Shrek, which is all this really is. Right then, Gainsborg, talking about the life of French singer Serge Gainsbourg. It's a biopic, so that's pretty much all the recap you need. It's covering his life. He obviously had a fairly eventful life. It goes all the way from his growing up in 1940s Nazi-occupied Paris, all the way through to his tempestuous relationships, including Brigitte Bardot, all the way through numerous falls from grace and then back into grace, and his death at the age of 62. Certainly he's led a very eventful life, and it makes for an entertaining film. It's told in a somewhat idiosyncratic style. From an early age, it seems that he has decided that part of his psyche should be split off and follow him around as a man with a large papier-mâché head. There's a tremendous physical performance from Doug Jones, who you may have seen in Pan's Labyrinth and Never Enough. He's the fairly tremendous physical actor. And he plays Laguerre, his mug, I believe would be the translation of that, I guess. I don't know enough about my psychology to know if it would be his ego or his id, but one of that is kind of following him around and giving him advice on how to progress through life, which is very, very strange. Obviously, it's not being a particularly documentarian look at the man's life. It is, however, quite an entertaining one. There's not an awful lot more that I can really say about it, other than it's very well acted and it's very well shot, and it kept me very well entertained for the 2 hours that it runs through. As I say, it's very competently executed. I had little or no interest in Gainsbourg before I walked into the film, and I suppose on that basis, it managed to keep me entertained and compelled for 2 hours means that it must be doing something right. It's not so good that I can recommend it to absolutely everyone, but certainly if you've even the vaguest hint of interest in the guy's life, then you'll get quite a bit out of this film. As I say, very well done, very competently executed, very enjoyable. Not altogether essential viewing, but certainly a very enjoyable one.
Next up we have The Karate Kid, and if you've seen the original Karate Kid, you know the story. If you've seen any other film ever, you probably know the story. And if neither of those are the case, then if you watch the first 10 minutes of this, then you'll know the story and exactly what will happen. Story, not really the strength of this film, but just for those of you curious, I'll give a quick recap of the plot. 12-year-old Dre leaves Detroit with his widowed mother Sherry to move to Beijing, where life and job prospects are better than in Motown. And being uprooted and moved halfway around the world, unsurprisingly, doesn't sit well with young Dre. But to be fair, Tommy does give his new home a whole 4, maybe even 5 days before declaring to his mother that he hates the place and is very unhappy. One of the legitimate reasons for his unhappiness, though, comes in the form of a group of bullies from his school, who also happen to be members of the local evil kung fu studio, and Dre suits the requirements as something on which to practice. During one such session, the handyman from Dre's apartment building, who just happens to be Jackie Chan, intervenes and dispatches the bullies. That's followed up by Jackie agreeing to teach Dre kung fu and Dre's entrance into a kung fu tournament, and everything after that goes exactly as you'd imagine, with no surprise of any kind, apart from the complete and utter lack of karate. This lack of surprises is one of the big problems, as if you have a predictable plot, mildly satisfying as a sporting underdog story as it may be to watch, you have to rely on the actors for most of the entertainment, and it's almost impossible to care about anyone in this film. But Jackie Chan unsurprisingly comes closest. It's definitely enjoyable seeing him beat up a bunch of kids, but his physical skills are never called upon after that, and he's given nothing of any substance to deal with, bar an unnecessary and mawkish backstory scene. Then there's Dre, played by Will Smith's son Jaden. While he's fortunately nothing like as unlikable and bratty here as he was in The Day of the Earth Stood Still, he's hard to care about. There's a stiffness to his performance, and he doesn't have an awful lot of screen presence. In this, it's not that he's unlikable, he just feels like a bit of a nothing. It's far too long as well, 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it takes an age to get anywhere. Something not helped by the fact that every time it gets going, it grinds to a halt, so what is ostensibly a training montage, but it's clearly a Chinese tourism promo, can be inserted. I can't think why else you'd travel quite a distance away from Beijing to train on top of the Great Wall of China, for some reason, or visit the Forbidden Kingdom, for some reason. And there are quite a few of those sort of scenes. Now, the 1984 original was every bit as cliched as this remake, but it had the important differentiating feature of being fun. To less jaded eyes than mine, you know, i.e. kids, who may not yet know how this sort of film goes, then it's probably a movie they can get some enjoyment out of. But given how expensive it is to take a family to the cinema nowadays, I'd recommend any parents wait until it comes out on DVD, or better yet, just rent the superior original.
Of course, the benefit of renting the original is that you've also rented this film as well.
It's almost scene for scene, isn't it?
Yeah, bafflingly blatant. I don't really understand what the point of it is. apart from it being a travel promo. I probably liked it a bit more than you did, but still not enough to recommend it to anyone. It's fine. It's basically just taking a film that I liked from ages ago and doing it again, but I don't see the point in doing it.
No, that was, have to say, the same for almost any remake ever, though.
True. I like Jackie Chan in this. I thought he was his usual self, but I don't like Jaden Smith at all. It's just plainly a role written for someone that's got more charisma than he does, and he just doesn't pull it off.
He's very, very, I think the word is stiff, and I think that's right. There's a natural at all. He's quite stiff, and I think he's quite limited.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's got no charisma, and I don't like him. But in this case, it was more just because there was nothing there to like, rather than, say, as the Daily Air Stood Still, when he was actively unlikable.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, the character's still doing some things that are pretty much unlikable. I mean, for all the thing, you know, oh, I'm getting bullied, it's like, well, you weren't really. You got picked on once, and then you were told, right, you just stay away from us and we'll leave you alone. And then he goes and picks them again. Ditches the gang leader in oil or whatever it was. It's like, well, that's just stupid.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
You deserve to get your ass kicked.
Although he does take an awful lot of time where nothing happens for that to come about too. Mm. Yeah, there's plenty of time to fit in some more actual bullying.
He wouldn't let it lie. Yeah, you know, that's fine. But
it's
why
pointless.
Bother?
It's very, yeah. Very pointless.
But if you like China, maybe it's good. No, there's really no reason for it to exist. It's by no means the worst film you will ever see, but it is one of the most pointless. Toy Story 3, then. There is probably very little point in recapping this, I guess. I would imagine pretty much everyone's seen Toy Story 3 by this point, but nonetheless, in a nutshell, Andy, the owner of the toys, is all grown up and about to go to college. He boxes up his toys with the intention of putting them into the loft, but a mix-up sees them donated instead to the Sunnyside Daycare Centre, which at first seems like the toys might have locked out rather than sitting in a loft for years until they are called upon again by their owner. They were going to be played with by lots of charming little children. However, Woody decides that he's still loyal to his owner and breaks out of the daycare centre and heads off to try and find Andy. This is fortuitous for him, as it turns out that the benefits of being in the daycare centre have been kind of oversold by the ringleader, Lotso, the seemingly adorable bear. Nonetheless, you can't keep the toys apart for too long. Woody decides that his place is with other toys, or other toys decide that their place is with Andy. They all come together in the end to try and break out and rejoin their master. In terms of plot, that is essentially it, but it doesn't really touch on quite how good the film is. I'd been kind of worried when it was confirmed that Toy Story 3 was going to happen, because one of the first things that happened after Pixar essentially took over the reins of Disney was that they were going to can all the junk that Disney were doing, of which Toy Story was going to be one of them. But thankfully they did wait until they've got a pretty good script for this. This is, I would say, on a par with the rest of the films. It certainly belongs in the same league as them. It's very, very charming. It's very funny. All the good characters that you like are still there. There's even a few new ones that are just as good. It's the plot's perfectly adequate for what it does, and it enables a lot of pretty good lines, some very good set pieces. The animation is, you know, fabulous. Pixar's doesn't need any more plaudits on that basis. Performances, again, are fantastic from everyone. It's very funny, it's amazingly likeable, it's touching at places, it's up there with Pixar's best film. Again, I don't know why I'm saying this, you've probably already seen it, and frankly, if you haven't, then you should.
Yes, you're mental. I can't disagree with a single thing you've said there. It's a fantastic film. There was a good few laugh out loud bits, but I just found it so enjoyable. And for the most of the film, I had this massive smile on my face almost the entire running time, apart from the few bits when I'm almost crying, and certain members of the one-liner almost certainly will. To the point where my face actually hurt quite a few times because I was just smiling so broadly. If I say much more, I'm just going to repeat exactly what you said. It's excellent, it's funny, touching, sentimental in places, without being too schmaltzy. It's a kind of pleasant send-off the character, it seems quite final. It's just a great film, and if you haven't seen it yet, stop listening to our podcast and go and watch it instead.
Indeed, it's just an amazingly charming film. Certainly as good a film as Pixar's done since the last Toy Story film, I'd say. For all the plaudits that was given to things like Up and Wall-E, I think this is as good as anything they've ever done.
I was never particularly on board with Wall-E, not the way other people were. They were going gag off. I really, really liked Up, but Toy Story 2 was still on high watermark, and I don't think this is better, but it probably matches it, which is pretty high praise, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think that's your lot for this podcast. We'll be back soon, no doubt, with some more films. But until then, I have been Scott Morris, and Drew Tavendale has been Drew Tavendale.
Goodbye.
We'll see you on the flip side.
Oh.
That'll do for that.